somebody says something like, oh, you're a trumpet player. And I say, I wanted to play trombone, but my father said it wasn't a girl's instrument.
People came to see me out of curiosity. Thought, oh, well, the girls on trombones, girls on trumpets, this must be seen to believe. I know that I could have gone out with, oh, anything, as long as I did a bit of sexy movements, but that was second in my mind. They had to play well.
Started to form in starting 41 because there was a demand for them all over the country. So there were, whether the girl musicians joined the male bands or joined the girl bands, at least there was work for everybody. It's too bad it took a war to do it.
Maxine Fields Nepper, Ivy Benson and Viola Smith, women instrumentalists from the golden age of big band swing. In Britain and the United States, the war years offered women jazz musicians a crack at the big time, although many had been working during the 20s and 30s to make a place for themselves in a man's world. Trumpeter Gracie Cole started out blowing with the Grimethorpe Colliery Band. It was an uphill struggle.
They had to make a decision if they wanted Yorkshire accent, a lass in band. Did they want a girl, you see, in the band? It would probably upset up their whole way of life, you know, having a mere lass in the band. Right enough, they did decide I could play with the band. You know, permanent member, Bellevue contests and the Albert Hall and everywhere. The only problem was that they didn't want me to travel in the band coach. I was with a girls' band before Ivy, Gloria Gay, all-girl band, and then Rudy Starita, an American, who had a girls' band for USO camp shows, equivalent to our ENSA. And then it was Ivy. Trill and me lie.
Welcome to Variety Bandbox. I'm very glad to see our next artist once again, what with overseas touring, 3,500 miles in 4 weeks, entertaining our boys in VAOR, and one thing and another, it's all too long since we last had the pleasure of welcoming that clever girl band leader, saxophone and clarinet player, Ivy Benson.
Formed in 1939, the Ivy Benson All-Girl Orchestra thrived for 40 years. Benson was easily Britain's most successful woman band leader and benefited enormously from the lack of competition during the war years. Although she wasn't alone, there were others like Blanche Coleman, Teddy Joyce's girlfriends, and Don Rico's Gypsy Girls. Sheila Tracy played trombone with Benson's band after the war.
She knew exactly what she wanted. And I think having been a member of the Teddy Joyce all-girls band, which is how she started, she went for an audition with Teddy Joyce when he had an all-male band. And everybody said, no, you can't possibly hire a girl. And he did, and she was his lead alto. And that inspired him to form a female band in about 1938, something like that. And Ivy was the lead alto in that band. It was called The Girlfriends. Ivy then thought, she wanted to form a band of her own. And, of course, she struck lucky because World War II broke out and her chance was shining. And eventually, Ivy was made the BBC's house band and sent down to Bristol, where they did their broadcasting. This caused a lot of trouble amongst the male band leaders. Billy Tennant was furious. I mean, he was the one that was against her. And she went to a meeting, I think, of band leaders at that time. And most of them got up and walked out. We're not having any woman band leader in here. If that's the way it is, we don't want anything to do with it.
Women who lived in the world of jazz had to be determined and prepared to take what opportunities were offered. Trumpeter Maxine Fields Knepper grew up in the Midwest of America. When she left school, she took a summer job playing for a religious cult who hired an all-girl band to attract converts from Chicago. She enjoyed the lifestyle.
That's when I decided, hey, I'm going to go on the road, you know, I'll figure out a way, you know, because I didn't know anybody or anything. Put ads in the Downbeat magazine and no response. And finally, some girl band came through, played one of the dance halls, so I went to see them. And yes, we do need a trumpet player, she said, you know. You got your horn? Yeah, I just happen to have it here. So I played for her and I was hired.
Helen Jones Woods lived in Mississippi with her adopted father, Lawrence Jones. Inspired by Booker T. Washington, he had founded Piney Woods School to give underprivileged children a chance in life. On a tour, raising money, he had seen Ina Ray Hutton and her Melodeers, one of America's most successful all-girl bands. Jones then realized an all-girl band would bring in the money. The International Sweethearts of Rhythm were formed.
There were 17 of us when the band was first organized, you know. Quite a number of us didn't do anything but hold instruments, but we were there, you know. There was a girl that came to Piney Woods. She was Chinese. And Mr. Jones was part Mexican. So he had Mexican students there, and he had this Chinese girl. So he decided, you know, he would put them in the band to give it a kind of a flavor, or so people, to attract people, you know. That's why they called it the International Sweethearts of Rhythm instead of the Sweethearts of Rhythm. The lady named Consuela Carter, she said, well, what are you going to do with Helen Jones? He said, well, she can play violin. And I said, no, I don't want to play violin. See, and that's how I got to play trombone. So I said, what can you do with her? Let her play the trombone if she wants to.
As the International Sweethearts of Rhythm lay it on us with Diggin' Dyke. Dig!
After we were together about a year, we decided that we could play dances. The band would make about $75 a night or something like that to play a dance. Always there was a good crowd. We were something new. It was something, there was nothing like that. We served a purpose. The audience had a purpose because it gave them something to do besides work, you know, every day.
Helen played with the International Sweethearts for over 10 years. Maxine Fields Knepper's career took the opposite course.
At that, I went to Houston, Texas to join Tony Wald. And we did a lot of USO. Then we paid for the Army. And that was a girl band. Traveled all through the South, Texas, Louisiana, New Mexico, I think Arizona. And then we came east, and we worked for the politician, and they danced without their shoes. How they found their shoes at the end of the evening, I don't know. Worked there quite a while, or, you know, a month or two, which is long for a musician very often. It's just one night. I worked altogether about 8 years on the road. It's hard to believe that all the bands I played in, I guess I didn't play with them very long. It has to be.
The women who became professional jazz musicians often came from musical families. In Wisconsin's Holy Land, Viola Smith's parents trained their 8 daughters to play as an all-girl family band. Inevitably, numbers dwindled and Viola and her sister Mildred set up the Coquettes on their own terms.
Actually, the 8 sisters were there only 2 years that we were all 8 sisters, because before that there were fewer in the orchestra, and then it dwindled down to just 2 of us left, but Sister Mildred and I. When by the time we formed the Coquettes Orchestra, we were only 2 left. We did very well with it. We always had work. We made it a cooperative orchestra. It helped the musicians in one respect. When it was the middle of winter and we were in St. Louis, the Scribner brothers in Boston offered us a string of one-nighters playing lucrative engagements. It was a wonderful opportunity, and yet we all decided against it. We voted on it. We didn't want to be in the New England states and travel in those snowstorms in the winter months, and so we turned it down. Oh, the manager, by the way, Carl Ayler, our manager, was so disappointed. Oh, can you imagine? He really would have loved that.
Although it was rare to go so far as forming a cooperative band, the Coquettes weren't the only women to resent their management. Even the schoolgirls of the International Sweethearts of Rhythm turned their backs on Piney Woods.
Our chaperone, Ray Lee Jones, told us one night, said, there's a young gentleman that's a big promoter, and he guarantees everybody would make over $100 a week. One night, after we played this dance somewhere down in Alabama or someplace, we just packed the bus and just left the school. Mr. Jones had a young man that was traveling with us that was supposed to take care of the money and look out after everything, you know. And while he was in counting the money, the bus left, you know. We took the instruments, too, which didn't belong to us.
Do you want to jump, children?
Yeah!
Do you want to jump, children?
Mr. Jones was so irate that we would walk away with his bus and his instruments. And he knew Ray Lee Jones was the one that convinced us by telling us, yes, you know, you need to be away from Piney Woods because you're not going to school. Piney Woods School is getting the money and you're getting nothing for it but working every night. So here's a man that's going to help us bridge that gap from school into the entertainment world. So everybody said, let's go for it. We went to an Apollo Theater. The band was so good that we would have lines all the way around the whole block waiting to get in. We were very popular, and we knew we were good. And we made a nice presentation.
When the Coquettes split up, Viola Smith moved to New York and joined Phil Spitalny's all-girl orchestra.
I joined Phil Spitalny in 1942. I auditioned 2 years earlier. I told him that someday I'll get off the road and I'll be available. 2 years later, I joined him. But I didn't have that in mind when I closed the orchestra, because I still thought I had offers from Woody Herman and Jan Savitt. These were top musician bands of the day. But I really wanted to, and they all traveled like we did with the Coquettes. What's the use? Would have been the same thing all over again, on the road again. And I wanted a home life. If you go on the road and you don't have a home base, you just keep traveling, traveling, traveling. And when you lay off in the town that you're in. Most of the bands traveled 50 or 40 weeks a year. And I had enough of that with the Coquettes.
Aren't
actually, I don't think I knew much about him at all.
Rosa Caruso Bellamy was playing bass in our high school orchestra when Spitalny first approached her.
He called me to come and audition, and my brother came with me, and he carried my string bass. As a matter of fact, a little tidbit, when we went up to his suite at the hotel, Mr. Spitalny opened the door, and he had a robe on. And my brother looked at him, and he said, "Get your clothes on. My sister is here." So that set the tone, and Mr. Spitalny knew that he had to have a little more consideration. I do remember one New Year's Eve. We were out of town, and it was the first time I was away from home. And I was in tears, and we did a midnight show of vaudeville. And when the curtains parted at midnight, I was crying on stage. That's what I remember. And then I called my family right after the show, and we cried some more. Sounds silly now.
Having burnt their bridges with Piney Woods, the Sweethearts were no longer recruiting new musicians from amongst the schoolgirls. They attracted experienced women instrumentalists and sometimes simply found them on the street. Carlene Ray, vocalist, pianist and bass player, and she's still performing, was walking home with fellow Juilliard student Edna Smith in New York. Edna was carrying her bass.
Edna and I were coming from our agent's office, walking back to the subway to go home. She was going to her house, and I was going to my house. And this gentleman came up to Edna and asked her, he said, "Excuse me, miss, but don't I know you?" And Edna says, "Well, I'm sorry, sir. If you're not a musician, I'm sorry, I don't have time." He says, "No, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Maurice King, and I'm the musical director for the Sweethearts of Rhythm, and I'm looking for some ladies to replace some ladies who are leaving soon." So we took him back upstairs to our agent's office, and he took all the pertinent information, said he would get in touch with us subsequently, which he did. So I joined the band the following week. Edna was already out there. That's how we got with the band. I wouldn't be able to make that story up. It really happened. And when we played a dance, it was like a dance in an auditorium that was segregated. White folks on one side, black folks on the other side, or white folks up in the balcony, black folks down on the floor. But in the Million Dollar Theater in Los Angeles, which is where the first big theater that I sang in, and that was the first time I sang Temptation. It just appealed to me. So it was a very emotional type of song. When I went out front to sing it, I just sang with all my heart and soul, and it stopped the show, and I was just flabbergasted. That had never happened to me before, but it was a nice reaction from the audience.
Life on the road is hard. In the States, travel itself was harder than ever during the war. Petrol and tires were rationed. There was even a victory speed limit. Many bands would travel between 300 and 500 miles a day, every day.
No way on the road was a conventional life, you know, especially when we did one-nighters, and that's what we would do. We'd usually do one-nighters in between the big towns. You know, we'd hit the bottom of our suitcase finally. The one-nighters, you just lived off of the top. I forgot I had some clothes. We did about 300 to 500 miles a day. It was not a conventional life, no. There was a free thing, and it was doing what I loved. I can recall doing some things that were pretty unusual, just because we knew we could, because we were going to be there the next night, you know.
Sherry Tucker has interviewed hundreds of veteran jazz women for her book on American women bands during the war called Swing Shift.
Women weren't thought to be tough enough to go on the road. Of course they were, and of course men had to be tough enough to go on the road too. Women were supposed to have families, right? And men also had families, but those families could stay at home and wait for them. I mean, these were all like preconceptions that people had. Of course, women did go on the road. Now, there were some differences, however, in being a man on the road and being a woman on the road. An all-woman band didn't just arrive in town and go on the bandstand. They had to have hairdos. They had to have makeup. They had to look glamorous. There were not dressing rooms available a lot of times, so they had to do this on the bus. There were additional kinds of labor that don't get counted as labor because they get seen as just sort of women's stuff. A lot of what women were required to do, men were not required to do, and it was especially difficult to do this on the road.
After 3 decades of dressing up, Carlene Ray hit on a solution.
Mercer Ellington and the Duke Ellington Band had offered me the job to go to Japan. I said to Mercer, I said, you know, I don't want to be bothered with the whole suitcase full of gowns and things like that, which I had many of. I still have some of the old gowns. I said, I'd rather have just maybe, you know, something like you guys are wearing tuxedos. You wear white jackets. Sometimes you wear black jackets. I said, how about that? Mercer said, very good idea. So I bought myself a couple of bow ties, some men's tuxedo shirts, and that's how I travel, you know. And then somebody would say, oh, that's a girl up there, you know. Speaking about a tuxedo, I was walking on 9th Avenue here, walking down to 42nd Street. So a lady comes up to me and she says, what are you doing with a tuxedo on? I says, well, I'm going to work. You know, she was offended by the fact that I was wearing a tuxedo. I find it amusing, but I didn't want to laugh in her face. But she was really incensed that I was wearing a tuxedo.
My first taste of life on the road was that trip from Spennymoor back to London after the dance. I think we left Spennymoor at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I know we got into London at 8:15 a.m. Now, that was the pattern in those days. Often, after we'd finished, we'd go on to the next venue. Ivy was very, very strict. The Eric Delaney Band were in Hamburg or some German town like that, the same time as the Ivy Benson Band. Now, the Ivy Benson Band all had to be in their hotel by whatever time, 10:30, 11 o'clock or something. And these girls actually knotted sheets and got out the window of the bedroom to meet the members of the Eric Delaney Band and go nightclubbing.
Men didn't have to think of their reputations.
The Sweethearts were very sheltered and very chaperoned.
Sally Plaxin compiled Jazz Women, one of the first attempts to acknowledge the contribution of women to jazz music.
Pauline Brady Williams, the drummer, told a story about trying to sneak out of the Hotel Teresa, I think it was, to go over to the Savoy or to the Apollo one night and, you know, getting caught and having to go back, because she said they were always trying to, you know, get out and get back past curfew.
I was still in high school, but I was called by Spitalny. I was the baby of the orchestra. And, of course, when we had to go out of town for the first time, it caused a tremendous upheaval in our family. But my mother made sure that I roomed with the oldest woman in the orchestra. And, of course, Mr. Spitalny had a very possessive attitude toward his musicians. He would look after us as if we were all his children, you know. And, of course, the older women resented it terribly. There were one or two that rebelled, you know, when he would say a curfew at a certain hour. And these were, you know, mature women, and some of them were married. And, of course, they didn't want his curfew.
It's not hard to understand the frustration that women would have felt under these circumstances.
Ivy had terrible trouble because she'd lost her pianist once on a gig in Germany shortly after the end of World War II, when she was very big with the American GIs over there. And this pianist said to her in the middle of the evening, oh, she said, can I just go and see Chuck? He's just come in. And Ivy said, yes, but don't be long. We're on the break, you know. Never saw her again. She just disappeared. I mean, she lost an enormous number of girls who married GIs.
sometimes they had to make choices that, male players wouldn't have had to make. You know, if they got married and had a family, they would have to decide if they could stay on the road. Clora Bryant went on the road. She had a number of kids. She was a trumpet player. She came out of the Prairie View College co-eds in Texas and played in a number of bands. And she's still playing in L.A. today and took her kids on the road.
For the Sweethearts, the difficulties of life on the road were more like dangers. In 1943, the band took its founding principles one logical step further and hired its first white musician. Here are Carlene, Helen, and Maxine remembering with Sherry Tucker.
There were black girls, white girls, Hawaiian girls, Latin girls, one Asian. We had one Asian in the band. That's why it was called the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. And I liked that. Although, that was also a detriment when we went traveling down south, because we were discriminated against consistently back in those days.
As long as you didn't integrate with the whites, they didn't care who, you know, who you associated with. In Mississippi, that was a rule, you know. Blacks played for the black dances and the whites played for the white dances. And we had these white girls with us that enjoyed being with the band so much, they would paint their faces with, you know, dark powder to make them look as dark as possible, you know.
The only time I called somebody, I contacted somebody and asked for the job. All the other times they called me. Quite some experiences going in the South. We had to pass for black, put dark makeup on our face. I learned to speak as though I were black. I don't know if it was unconscious, but I automatically did that. So sometimes when they would question my race, they'd say, well, you sound black.
A lot of time, the police would come and ask what nationality were they. Now, in Mississippi, there were a lot of blacks that looked white because they had integration down there, bedroom integration, but they didn't have social integration, you know what I mean? See, some of the girls looked white. Their mother was black, you know. It was quite a shock to us to realize that these white girls had to pretend they were blacks in order to travel with us because they thought that was unfair, you know what I mean?
I remember once in Florida. Now, that was a big dance. Sometimes we played tobacco warehouses, the huge places, you know, and the police would be there and we could feel them looking at us, you know, and like trying to figure it out. And Duke, who was the husband of Anna May, who led the band, he was a really shrewd character. He'd tell them, yeah, there's some white girls in there. And then he'd say there were two white girls when there's really three. But if you want to cause any trouble, you better get the right two. And so that's why they kept looking at us all the time. Fortunately, we were just finagled our way out of it, you know. It could have been other because there was, for mixing, they can get really very nasty. Probably beatings, take you to prison. I remember joining the band and they had a good talk with me on how to behave and what to say and so forth so that they avoid any trouble. Very fearful.
1943 is the first white member was added to the International Sweethearts of Rhythm in 1943. Her name was Toby Butler, and Toby Butler was a trumpet player who was white but who had been raised by a black family. And so we're not just talking about integration. We're talking about a kind of integration that was going on in black communities far earlier than the civil rights movement. The one-drop rule refers to a kind of law
There were many variations of this law, but the one drop rule refers to a law in which anyone with any known African ancestry was black, was legally black. And so there were many, many people who looked white, who were mostly white, but who were legally black in black communities. There was a great deal of diversity in black communities. There was a great deal of colorism when it came to women in African-American entertainment. And so many of the women who were on the stage who were African-American were very light-skinned. Therefore, in some ways, it was easier for a white woman to pass as a light-skinned black woman than it was for a dark-skinned black woman to pass as a light-skinned black woman.
Now, Helen herself is mixed. So, as were a few of the other girls, because she was light-skinned and could pass for white, she was able to go, as some of the other girls, too, were able to go into some of the better restaurants in some of the towns we went in, and we went to the little local greasy spoons, as we would call them. But we didn't miss out on any good meals, I'll be frank with you. Just because we didn't eat as classily as some white folks ate, it didn't mean that we weren't eating well. But it was just the principle of the thing, being discriminated against.
Usually if we worked in the South, we stayed in the black neighborhood, you know. Don't go across that line. You know, we stuck our neck out. You know, I remember getting injured. What? Yeah, I had an accident, and it broke my ribs. And to go to the hospital, the black hospital there, they were afraid to treat me, you know, and that was difficult. It would be very risky to cross that line and go over into the white, and still the black doctors were afraid to treat me also. Fortunately, we went to L.A. right after that, so I got treatment, but yeah.
Man said last night he was going away. When I got through, he decided to stay. I'll do the tiny boogie. I'll do the tiny boogie. You do the tiny boogie. You do it all night long. Girls, you got a good man. You better take care. You wake up some mornings and he won't be there. He'll be doing the tiny boogie. Yes, you do the tiny boogie. Oh, you do the tiny boogie. You do it all night long.
This is Some Like It Hot, all-girl jazz bands in the 1940s. I'm Cleo Lane, and you are listening to Tiny Boogie, played by the International Sweethearts of Rhythm, featuring Ernestine Tiny Davis on vocals and trumpet.
Be a tough thing for a female musician. Looking the other day, and I was watching a television program, and they had a backing band, very good, excellent, you know, first-class musicians. But I looked at them, they were elderly and bald heads and white hair and glasses, and I thought to myself, supposing I put a girls' band looking like that on there, I would be torn to pieces. That's what I can't stand. You've got to look like Marilyn Monroe and play like Buddy Rich, you know, sort of, you don't stand a chance.
Ivy Benson talking straight. Gracie Cole remembers the investment Ivy made in presenting her musicians.
It was very important to have the right dress, and she spent a lot of money on dresses for the band. I think on one occasion, she spent £1,000 on getting new dresses for the band. They had to be pastel shade lace gowns, especially made.
There's no doubt that the most successful of all the girl bands were fronted by glamorous women. Maxine played for a while with Ina Ray Hutton.
Oh, Ina Ray Hutton, she started her own band. She was the Blonde Bombshell. She fronted some male bands for a while, and for some reason or other, she started a girl band that was in L.A., and we worked a huge ballroom on Santa Monica Beach, and on Sunday, we had a TV show. She sang and kind of danced around on the stage, and real showbiz stuff. Real sexy.
It was a constant balancing act because these women were doing something that wasn't ladylike. It wasn't something that women were thought to do. And so to make it interesting for people to come and hear them, they had to also perform a kind of femininity that counterbalanced the image of women playing trombones, saxophones, drums. And this actually created a kind of titillating blend that audiences liked a lot, and a lot of the bands were very popular.
I saw her once. She was a very attractive girl, very glamorous. Her approach was quite different than Spitalny's. You know, ours was more sort of ladylike, if I may dare say that. Although certainly Ina Ray was a lady. I don't mean to imply that. But her approach was more commercial, I feel.
The bands that were the most famous bands, and these were by and large the white bands that could make it into the kinds of circuits that fame was built on. And by this I mean broadcasting, I mean major dance halls, ballrooms, I mean the major theaters. These were white venues. And so the white all-girl bands that became very famous, you can see the kinds of popular, idealized white femininity that they were tapping into. So Ina Ray Hutton's band, for instance, Ina Ray Hutton performed a kind of blonde bombshell image that was popularized by Jean Harlow in the 30s. And her performance in front of the band drew attention away from the fact that the women were playing well and were playing hot music. Another balancing act can be seen in Phil Spitalny's Hour of Charm Orchestra, which I see as an evocation of the angel of the hearth, the cult of true womanhood, the long dresses that somebody told me cost $500 a piece during the 1940s. And this kind of image drew attention away from the fact that there were women playing tuba, there were women playing drums, there were women playing trombones in that band. It made them seem more like ladies in the parlor entertaining guests.
Certainly women musicians had to entertain as well as being good instrumentalists. Viola Smith.
I played drum acts. In fact, in Canada, I was booked as an act, but it was too much work for me, and I decided not to book myself as an act again. I did a typewriter thing where I typed to a music and made all the sounds on the typewriter that one would hear in the music. Anyway, it was a good act.
A good act, but there's a catch.
Many musicians said we were novelties, you know, that we used to hear that all the time. They are novelties and they make a good presentation, you know. I mean, that's all we ever heard. Now that we've all gotten old, those same musicians that we worked, you know, that we knew, they've gotten old. Those girls were good. But at that time, they said no.
Novelty. The whole thing in those days was that women were not treated with respect. They were treated as novelties. And so that was always in my craw, and I always never wanted to be that much with women because of the fact that they were treated as novelties. And I consider myself a serious musician, and I wasn't going to tolerate that kind of thing, which probably was part of my motivation too, you know, for just going ahead and doing what I wanted to do, you know. But and that's, I think maybe I have I was running away from trying to play with women. I just didn't want to play with women because of that, you know, because I didn't want to be considered a novelty.
Helen remembers that while some accepted the sweethearts, others cold-shouldered them.
We worked with Count Basie's old band. We knew the musicians. And, you know, we knew some of the musicians in Duke Ellington's band. I knew the trombone player, Lawrence Brown, real well. And I knew Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong was one musician that got along with everybody. He always, you know, he came and he was very friendly. And he'd have barbecue. His sister would send him. And he would give the girls some of it and things like that. He was a very, very friendly person, you know, very nice, you know. But the rest of them, no, you know. Years ago, there used to be warehouses in North Carolina and South Carolina, tobacco warehouses. They would clear the warehouses out, and then they would let the blacks use it as a place for dancing. So we would play, you know, play there, and we would play the ballad bands in those different warehouses. And the dance would start at 9, and sometime would end at 4 o'clock in the morning. Fletcher Henderson would play a while, and so did Earl Hines would play a while, and we would play a while whenever we played against those two different bands, you know. The artists, men, the artists would always say, because we were women, you know, and all like that. They say, you all sound better than they do. We say, yeah, we know, tell us more, you know.
Ivy Benson said to the tenor saxophone player, Lena Kidd, who was the other jazz player in Ivy's band at the time, we did the jazz, she said, would you like to go to a jazz club? And so, right enough, she took us to Ostend Jazz Club, and it was a marvellous experience. Ivy took her clarinet, with the three of us blew. We couldn't speak the language to the musicians. They looked in surprise when we walked in, said hello. We managed to talk via the musicians' twang, their universal language. In the jazz world, all the keys for all the Honeysuckle Rose, Lady Be Good, Ivy's signature tune, they all have a recognized key. Wherever you go. So Honeysuckle Rose in whatever country would be in the key of F. F has one flat in the key signature. So your finger would go down for the key of F. So you'd say, Honeysuckle Rose. And the musician looked at it, yeah, yeah. And then you point your finger down, yeah. And off we went and had a wonderful time.
The person that wasn't friendly was Billie Holiday. And I don't blame her. The first time we came to Washington to play at the theater, we couldn't play her music. And she walked off the stage. Her husband made her come back, a boyfriend, and he told her, you know, you had to get your start. You had to get started once, too, see. So she sang, but she wasn't pleased working with us, you know. And I can understand now, as great as she is, why she had her attitude.
There's another story about Billie Holiday playing with another band called the Darlings of Rhythm. Now, the Darlings of Rhythm is an interesting band because they were quite popular in the mid-40s. I'd say they were as popular in the African-American press as the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. However, the Darlings of Rhythm were never recorded. One of the reasons for that is because they had less money behind them. They didn't have beautiful uniforms. They didn't have arrangements. They played head arrangements. For the same reasons, they had more improvisers. They played more riffs. And in fact, their music was preferred by some of the women that I interviewed because it was more jazz. They had more soloists. The International Sweethearts of Rhythm would kill me for saying this, but the Darlings of Rhythm were very popular with some people. Another reason they might not have been as well known is the Darlings of Rhythm tended to have darker-skinned members. Billie Holiday sang with the Darlings of Rhythm at the Grand Terrace Ballroom, and she was very upset with the band. During dress rehearsal, she yelled at the band because they were playing with too much power, and she said, "Can't you all play like Paul Whiteman?" And Paul Whiteman was a very sweet, watered down, some people would say in the 1940s, big band, a white all-male band, which one might not expect Billie Holiday to be asking for. But the Darlings of Rhythm were a loud band, and they played with a lot of power, and she was surprised at what she was hearing, and she wanted them to tone it down. The women that we remember are the women who were singers, sometimes piano players. But singers were seen quite differently than instrumentalists in jazz bands, even if they were male singers. Men who operated instruments were seen as skilled. Women who stood in front of the band in a gown, who sang about private emotions were seen as not skilled, not professional, not doing something that required training, but as emoting from their hearts. Billie Holiday, until recently, very recently, has been most often written about for her tragic life. Now, of course, we know that Billie Holiday also is one of the major contributors to modern jazz. She's a major player in the transition from the big bands to bebop. But Billie Holiday seldom gets that kind of credit. She gets seen as a woman doing an African-American woman who's expressing pain for all of us.
You see, with jazz, there has to be something inside of you that you can develop and nurture and so forth. I mean, there has to be something coming from inside of you. It's not just something that you can just copy from somebody else, because that's not going to work. Jazz is the kind of music that the particular performer has to make a contribution of his or her own from within. It's got to be part of your musical persona, let's put it that way. It's all right to be copying someone's solos on whatever instrument you feature yourself on, but that's that person's solo. That's not you. Unless you're going to put yourself into it and start creating and composing on the spot. That's where improvisation comes in. In fact, that's what it's all about. That's the essence of jazz, improvisation. And that's it. It's just that simple. But it's not that simple as far as propagating it, as far as developing it is concerned.
Whether women had the opportunity to sort of explore their musical voice in the way that men did is another question. You know, whether they were able to become great innovators or to have that opportunity, which is not to say that they couldn't do it, but to have the opportunity and the sort of taken for granted quality that you would woodshed and you would, you know, trade ideas and you would be able to do that is something that I think they didn't always have access to. And again, you know, if you look at Mary Lou Williams, she's one of the great giants, and certainly was right in the middle of all jazz activity and all innovation and way ahead of her time very often. So I think often people say women couldn't do it. And I think really the point is that not whether they could or couldn't, because we'll never know, but that they perhaps didn't have the opportunities to develop to that point, and that they were able to develop to the point that they could, given, you know, the times and the limitations. Because there was enormous dedication among the women that I talked to, and I talked to about 70 women, maybe more, and, you know, the dedication and the commitment that they had to jazz and to that life and to their bands and to their, you know, women that they played with was enormous.
Their dedication may have been enormous, and they may have been as popular as the next band with the audiences, but many all-women jazz bands were never recorded. Viola Smith and Sherry Tucker.
Many, many jazz and swing histories have been based on the history of jazz and swing records, and this is definitely one of the reasons why all-woman bands aren't remembered today.
You didn't hear Ina Ray Hutton's band, and or Rita Rio's band, or Ada Leonard, if they recorded. I'm not even aware whether or not they did, but the generations didn't hear about it, whereas Glenn Miller will live forever. I never knew why the girl bands didn't record as much as the men bands, because they were very good, very good. In fact, you close your eyes, you didn't know whether you were listening to a girl band or male band, the top bands, the girl bands. And it's never even crossed my mind, why didn't they record more? It's a form of prejudice, because even the powers that be probably didn't even think of it. One thing leads to another. So all the male bands were recording, so they continued. The line of least resistance.
My own theory about why women's bands weren't recorded more than they were is that the feminine difference couldn't be recorded on audio. And the only reason all-woman bands were popular was because they were a spectacle. And I hate to say this, because of course the women musicians didn't see themselves this way. And they had the same types of skills. They had training, they took themselves very seriously as musicians. But the way that they were marketed could only happen if they were seen as a spectacle. They were sort of like cross-dressers. They were sort of tapping into that kind of shock and titillation, a woman doing something that wasn't expected. And you couldn't capture that on audio. If a woman's band sounded like a men's band, why not give the recording gig to a men's band? This is the way that the recording studios were thinking. But some of the women's bands did make it into some short films or soundies. But what I'm trying to say is that they were consumed differently, they performed differently because they had to, and they were historicized differently because of that.
Many of the stories of all-women jazz bands have been collected just in time to prevent them from being lost forever. Jazz pianist Marion McPartland's personal quest to trace the international sweethearts of rhythm led to a revival of interest in all-girl bands. The Sweethearts got together one last time at the Women's Jazz Festival in Kansas in 1980. I remember meeting them because I was performing there too. No one knows for sure how many all-women bands toured America and the United Kingdom. When the war was over, many of the women who had worked full-time in jazz bands were asked to give up their seats. In fact, the end of the war really created a further setback for women musicians who had long since earned their place on the bandstand.
To break into the kinds of venues that had been closed to them before the war. During the war, they played the same venues that the men's bands had been playing. At the same time, they were taken less seriously as professionals. Women's bands, even though they were filling these major venues and they had careers that were flourishing, were seen as cheerleaders for the troops. After the war, many working women were funneled into other kinds of work that was thought of as feminine work. So women who had worked in the defense industries as welders, building airplanes, got funneled into pink-collar jobs, into clerical work, etc. And women who had played in all-girl bands, a lot of them were able to continue musical careers, but as teachers, as accompanists, as Hammond organ players in cocktail lounges.
Maybe they've been ignored on purpose, because they certainly were back in those days. Women were not taken seriously. They were just novelties and so. And even if they were good, a lot of men wouldn't even want to admit it. Like, for instance, when Vi Burnside played, she handled her instrument so beautifully that it was hard for some men to believe that she could play that well, you know. What are you going to do? Life doesn't stop just because some guy doesn't believe that you can play something. And I've had men stand up and look at me and say, you know, as if to say, well, how dare you sound like that, you know? No, I'm serious, you know. So, I mean, and I don't worry about it. God gave me the talent and I'm going to use it. You know, it's just that simple. I don't beat anybody over the head about it. I think you just have to take it in stride, and just keep on keeping on. just the world of jazz. It's just a male attitude about women, period. Suppose you put a bunch of musicians, male and female, behind a screen, and you have them all play. Now, I dare you to pick out what gender each instrument is. Now, does that solve the problem? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Rosa Caruso Bellamy, Gracie Cole, Maxine Fields Nepper, Sally Plaxin, Carlene Ray, Viola Smith, Sheila Tracy, Sherry Tucker, and Helen Jones Woods were talking about all women bands with archive recordings of Ivy Benson.